Welcome to The Value of Knowing, the podcast where we dive deep into the world of legal complexity and opportunity on the vibrant continent of Africa. Stay tuned for expert insights and a closer look at the legal landscape in Africa, where Bowmans helps its clients to manage legal complexity and unlock opportunity. That's The Value of Knowing.
I'm your host, Alison Mellon. As a seasoned banking and finance lawyer with extensive experience in secured and syndicated lending, I now focus on knowledge asset development, thought leadership, and client value-added services here at Bowmans. Today, I'm delighted to be joined by two distinguished guests. First, we have Alan Luter, the head of our banking and finance department and co-head of our infrastructure sector group. Alan is based in our Johannesburg office and brings a wealth of experience in project development and financing transactions across Africa. Later in the episode, we'll be joined by Shamila Grimwood, a partner in our banking and finance department. Shamila has extensive experience in power and infrastructure projects and has been recognized for her exceptional work in project finance and development across multiple African countries. In this episode, we'll be discussing the recently released Bowmans Energy Report, which covers key energy trends and legislative reforms impacting the energy sector across sub-Saharan Africa. We'll delve into the insights and implications of this report, highlighting significant developments and opportunities within the region. We'll also take a moment to focus on the implications of legislative reform in South Africa, especially on the issue of grid transmission. So let's get started. Alan, I'm interested in hearing how you'd describe the state of the energy sector across sub-Saharan Africa. Please give us your thoughts about the status quo.
One of the frameworks within which I like to look at questions of access to energy on the continent is through the framework of the energy trilemma, which is looking to solve for questions of energy security, one, questions of sustainability, two, and also questions of affordability, and also taking that context and looking at some of the objectives that have been articulated at a policy level. So if you look at some of the two key goals articulated in the African Development Bank's high fives, is light up, empower Africa, which goes to this question of electrifying the continent and making sure that people have access to clean sources of energy, among other things. And contrasted to that is the question of industrializing Africa, which also means that you need secure and reliable sources of energy or electricity as a form of energy as part of the achievement of those goals. And when you look at the potential sources of energy for the African continent, I think renewable energy sources are quite an important source of energy, but also your traditional primary energy sources remain quite important as part of the potential energy mix. And one of the things that have come through iterations of COP is that we probably need to look at natural gas, for example, as an important transitional source of energy. And a few countries on the continent have potential hydrocarbon resources that may answer the global supply question. But this happens at a time where a number of funding institutions have articulated positions that suggest that there will not be financial support for development of those resources on the African continent, which goes towards a tension between a growth path that seeks to maximize access to electricity, access to clean sources of energy, that seeks to increase energy security with these shackles, as it were. And maybe shackles is a strong word, but with these restraints that seem somewhat inconsistent when you see how, I'll call it, the global north has responded to some of its energy challenges in light of the conflicts that we're seeing happening, particularly in Russia and Ukraine, which have placed pressure on the traditional sources of gas supply and for Europe, and have compelled countries to seek alternative sources of supply, and also in some instances to bring back carbon intensive sources of electricity generation just to meet the energy demands, particularly during the winter. So South Africa is at a time where I think at a policy level, countries need to be clear about what it will take to achieve the objectives of expanding access to electricity and at the same time solving for containing the continent's contribution to greenhouse gas emissions. By way of landscape, that's where I'd summarize the state of the energy sector in the continent.
That's very interesting. You've really touched on some of the key challenges and some of the opportunities that we can see as well as the tension from global climate goals as well. In our latest publication, the Bowman's Energy Report, we focused on quite a few sub-Saharan African countries. I wondered, in your view, which are the countries to watch out for in terms of significant progress in the energy sector in the next 12 months, and why would you pick these particular countries?
Across our footprint, I'd say quite a number of interesting things are happening, starting with Kenya, for example, which has seen a rise in captive power and commercial and industrial solar projects. These are private sector driven projects which don't rely on government financial support to get them off. And this is quite important in the context of doing deals in African jurisdictions. One of the important developments in Kenya, which has showed significant potential over time, is that Cabinet recently announced that it would lift its moratorium on the signing of new power purchase agreements. And I think at the same time, it published a report recommending the renegotiation of existing power deals and reforming future energy agreements to bring electricity costs down. I think what's important with lifting that moratorium is that it opens up space, in particular, for private sector players who are looking to solve or indeed to create private solutions for private electricity access challenges to do that. Mauritius, interestingly, has set itself a goal to reach 60% of renewable energy supply by 2030. That's coupled with a commitment to phasing out coal by then. One of the interesting things will be watching how the country does that, particularly given that when you massify your renewable generation capacity, you need to do things like invest in strengthening your grid capacity. You need to solve for the intermittency, and solving for intermittency means things like battery energy storage systems, which I think is part of the policy thinking. It also means flexible sources of supply. And it will be interesting to see what the policy directions in ensuring that an energy mix emerges that gives Mauritius energy security. I'll also touch on Namibia, which I think is probably on the cusp of something transformative, because in the energy sector in particular, they've made some significant discoveries of hydrocarbons, which have the potential to transform the Namibian energy sector and also the regional energy supply balance. But one of the interesting things about Namibia is how it's approaching its hydrocarbon bounty, and also how it's contextualizing this in the universe of responsible development that also acknowledges the need to meet climate change goals, decarbonize, and also ensuring that there is an energy mix and a mix of developments that includes your renewable energy generation capacity, your traditional sources, as well as some interesting projects in the hydrogen sector. And I think it will be interesting to watch that, because it remains unclear to me, if you can pull those off on a massive scale, but Namibia seems to be on track to do that, and doing that at the same time as developing its hydrocarbon potential. And it goes to that theme that I alluded to earlier, which is when you have hydrocarbon resources that can potentially change the fortunes of the people in the country and the region, that can potentially help to solve, for at least on the resource equation, some of the other issues that confront developing nations. What is the moral argument, basically, for saying that those should stay in the ground? And I don't think that's an issue that Namibia faces, because you've seen some significant interest from the major developers in the sector, in that economy, but also just seeing policy clarity and the creation of environment that enables Namibia to potentially realize the potential of its energy resources in a balanced way. South Africa is also exciting. I mean, probably one of the largest energy markets in the region. And the exciting story about South Africa is the transformation that we've experienced over the decade in the energy sector, particularly in the electricity supply sector. If we recall, the traditional structure of the South African electricity industry was a vertically integrated one, with Eskom as the utility at the core of generation, distribution, and transmission. What we saw, I think, from around 2011, it was the beginnings of the expansion of independent power producers in the generation sector, particularly of renewable energy generators, who were brought into the market through well-organized and structured procurement program, the REIPP, which effectively liberalized generation. And I think the success of that program in creating a market for IPPs is demonstrated really in how the private sector, and how you've seen over the last 3 years or so, the emergence of a private sector driven corporate PPA market that doesn't depend on government support for its success. And we're right in the middle of this private generation market. And this is the result, really, of the liberalization of certain measures in the Electricity Regulation Act, which opened up the space for private generators to establish generating facilities without the need for generating licenses. And that has been an important development, I think, in the generation sector. But as you know, when it comes to massifying renewable energy generation capacity, it doesn't end there, because you need to make sure, because of the intermittency factor, that you're solving for grid stability. So one of the other important developments in the South African market has been the, and it's in progress right now, and it's been the establishment of the National Transmission Company as a separate independent entity, while still a subsidiary of Eskom, but a separate independent entity that has the responsibility for managing the transmission grid of the country. And with the massification as well of private generation capacity, you've also seen the emergence of the trading environment, and increasingly of the licensing of power traders. And there's been significant private market activity to expand the sources of electricity supply outside of the established utility. And I think these are very important developments in the jurisdiction which harbor well.
Would you like to take us through which types of renewable energy projects are currently receiving attention at the moment, and why you think these are the particular projects of choice at the moment?
We've seen a lot of solar PV plants. We've seen some wind projects. I think solar PV is probably one of the least complicated projects to implement. Wind in areas where the wind resource is abundant, You've seen those projects being implemented there, onshore wind, I'm talking. I think the cost of solar panels has come down significantly, making solar PV projects particularly attractive and particularly less challenging to implement if you can solve for the land issues and the access to grid issues, which remain important challenges in the South African context. Access to grid issues affect, I think, all kinds of RE projects. We've also seen on the public procurement side, the battery energy storage system procurement projects being launched as part of an effort to solve for that question of grid stability. And in the private sector, it's largely been solar and wind.
One of the emerging trends in the energy sector in South Africa is the massive increase in the number of private-to-private or CNI IPPs.
Mm.
You mentioned these earlier, which was very interesting. And obviously, these IPPs generate and sell electricity directly to commercial and industrial consumers or customers. What are some of the challenges that we are seeing for these projects, as these may be ones which arise in other jurisdictions around sub-Saharan Africa as well?
So the key issue in these projects, when you've solved for locating it in an area with the relevant renewable energy resource, has been access to grid capacity. And part of the challenge has been that the necessary investment in transmission grid capacity in some of the key resource-rich corridors of the country has lagged behind potential projects that could come on stream in those regions. And I think one of the constraints has simply been access to resources. I think the Eskom balance sheet has been stressed for some time, and measures are afoot to solve for that. The issue of transmission grid capacity layout is not a new issue. And I think when the initial round of the renewable energy program was being implemented, Eskom became aware of this issue. And to solve for this issue, a method of grid capacity build out was implemented. And that method was the self-built method, which Eskom, in its capacity as licensed transmission entity, was able to enable private projects to build pieces of grid to connect to the main grid by themselves on a self-built basis and then hand that over to Eskom. In the absence of a more systemic framework for building grid capacity, which allows IPPs to recoup the investment that they put in those grid assets, the self-built model remains an important method through which private actors have sought to solve, particularly in those areas where there's significant potential for their projects, have sought to solve, in some cases, through multi-project cooperation. And it's easier when there's one developer, more complex on that different developers. But where commercial interests are aligned, you've seen private developers cooperate to build portions of grid connection assets using the self-build model, which then allows them to create the capacity that they need, whether immediately or down the line, to ensure that the power generated by their projects can be evacuated. So the question of grid is not a uniquely South African one. In some jurisdictions, particularly when you have IPP projects that develop, and sometimes one of the devices that you use as part of a project financing structure to solve elements of the bankability equation is to allocate the risk of grid completion to the public utility, which is responsible for those assets. And the method through which you do that is to create this device that allows you to be paid for what are called deemed energy payments. So The premise is that if the generation facility is available to generate electrons, but the grid infrastructure that's required to be built by the public entity to connect to the facility and evacuate the power at the point of supply is not ready. Even though no actual electrons are being evacuated onto the grid because the grid infrastructure is not ready, the IPP will be paid as if it was, on the basis that the delay in completing the grid connection assets is attributable to delays by the transmission owner, which in most cases tends to be the public utility company. Now, what has happened in some jurisdictions is that this has created some interesting tensions, with parts of the public sentiment being convinced that these IPPs are getting a bounty for energy that's not produced. I think a famous example is a great project in Kenya called the Lake Turkana project, where it had some challenges. Some of the discussions in the public domain about the project turned on this question of a project that's not actually delivering electrons to the grid being paid for electrons that are not on the grid. And a part of that public discourse that's missing is that question around risk allocation, which forms the basis on which you are able to attract long-term financing for significant generation capacity of that nature. So in some cases, it's a question of awareness of the bargain that it takes to deliver assets. But this question of grid access and grid assets and who's responsible for delivering those is an important one across the region.
Do you think that there are other ways more generally that South Africa could accelerate the scale of their projects and investment in the energy sector?
One of the most significant constraints in South Africa today is that question that I've alluded to of expanding grid capacity. And also, it's probably not just expanding grid capacity. It's ensuring that South Africa has an energy mix that enables it to integrate massive renewable energy generation, which contributes importantly to the decarbonization objective without destabilizing its grid. And to this extent, I think the potential gas program, I think, is an important part of solving all this equation in a way that introduces a transitional source of energy to solve for the equation of energy security, as well as enabling the integration of renewable sources of generation, and also over time, decreasing the reliance of the South African generation mix on its coal fleet, which is a function of history and the abundance of the resource in the geography where South Africa is.
Thank you, Alan, for taking us through the status quo in the energy sector in sub-Saharan Africa. It's been significant to discuss the impact of global climate goals, as well as the ongoing issue of access to affordable electricity. It was useful to also hear the recent developments in the energy sector in South Africa, where legislative reforms have led to significant renewable energy generation, particularly in relation to C&I customers. Keeping the focus on South Africa, I'd like us to spend the last segment of this episode discussing the significant Electricity Regulation Amendment Bill. It's currently awaiting the President's signature after being passed by both the National Assembly and the National Council of Provinces. To this end, I'd like to welcome Shamila Grimwood. One of the important recent changes has been around our electricity framework in South Africa. I just wondered if you could outline for us what the electricity framework has been like prior to the latest amendments, and then we can discuss a little bit more about what the Electricity Regulation Amendment Bill is and some of the criticisms that have been against it.
The bill is long overdue. It was anticipated as far back as 1998 with the Energy White Paper. It's quite a massive step forward. It proposes to essentially fast forward our electricity supply market into the current century. The existing Electricity Regulation Act is not a very sophisticated piece of legislation. It is very out of date and is sparse in areas where greater clarity is required. So the current electricity environment, I mean, everybody knows we have essentially a vertically integrated supply chain with transmission infrastructure solely owned and operated by Eskom. Eskom also owns about 40% of the physical distribution network infrastructure, the balance being owned mostly by municipalities. And then, of course, the bulk of our generation is owned by Eskom, although over the last 10 years there's been the introduction, as everyone knows, of some private generation capacity, I think around 6 gigawatts of renewable energy. And then there were the peaker plants, 1 gigawatt, that were completed in about 2014. That said, the existing market is predominantly a single buyer market for generators. The bulk of generators supply to Eskom under the DMRE controlled Section 34 procurement process. And as everybody is aware, over the last 2 years, there's been a lifting of licensing requirements for generators, with the result that there is a nascent or developing private market, as it were, where IPPs are selling to C&I off-takers. The uptake is still very slow. We're at the very start of this particular development, and there are some pressing obstacles to the sort of prolific increase in these arrangements. And that relates to uncertainty regarding wheeling. Wheeling is essentially the ability of generators and buyers to use the network of third-party network operators, essentially to purchase power. And the biggest gap, I suppose, in the current regulatory environment is particularly at the level of distribution. In the case of these sort of existing municipal distributors, out of the 168 municipalities that are actually able to provide network services, as far as we're aware, only 3 or 4 of them have actually established a wheeling policy, despite the statutory obligation as it currently exists of licensed municipal distributors to provide third-party access to their networks. They are, in fact, not doing so. Fast forward to the bill. What the bill does is apart from setting out an enabling environment for a revised electricity supply industry, which will comprise a hybrid market model, allowing for a voluntary pooling, physical bilateral transactions, and regulated transactions. All of this is underpinned by the principles in the bill that relate to third-party access. So the bill puts quite a significant emphasis on third-party access, and it is absolutely clear that effectively wheeling and access to third-party networks is a key principle, and it is obligatory for all licensed distributors and transmitters to allow this to occur. The key aspect addressed in the bill is around the transparency of pricing of network services as an essential criteria for third-party access.
Do you think that the bill deals with the issue of third-party access in a succinct way, or is it quite a convoluted approach to it?
No, I think it does so in a succinct way, but the devil's in the detail. What the third-party access will need to be fully fleshed out through rules or regulations. I think the bill is just, it lays out the principles more clearly than perhaps the existing act, but the reality is the detail around third-party access is going to have to be addressed through rules and regulations. So my query is, how quickly will DMRE and or NERSA action the preparation of these rules and regulations, given that, in fact, these rules and regulations could have been passed under the existing Act, because under the existing Act, already it was anticipated that third-party access rules or regulations should be developed. This has never been done. And the other issue that we're aware of is that, in fact, apparently NERSA has been working on rules for third-party access for a decade. So my concern is, you know, if they didn't do it under the existing Act, are they going to do it under the new bill? Or is the new bill going to become a white elephant? Because the success of the bill will depend on all of the sort of legislation that needs to be developed to implement the principles set out in the bill.
That's very interesting. Are there other criticisms that have been levied against the bill or from other parties or other actors who we haven't discussed so far?
Yes, I think municipal distributors have raised concerns that the bill attempts to limit their constitutional rights to impose surcharges on their electricity prices. Under the Constitution, I think it's section 229, municipalities are entitled to impose surcharges on their services. And this is essentially an original taxing power that municipalities have constitutionally. And the reality is, quite frankly, I think the bill addresses the issue of surcharges in a very contradictory fashion. And so on the one hand, it would appear that surcharges are carved out under the bill of nurses' oversight. There are other provisions in the bill that contradict this. So I think this issue is very unfortunate. And I don't think the drafters of the bill paid sufficient attention to actually addressing this issue correctly. So I think this is a big gap in the bill, because it's quite confusing as to whether NERSA can regulate these surcharges or not. And we do anticipate that this is probably going to be the subject of potential litigation by bodies such as SALGA going forward.
That really does explain the need for the bill and the fact that it's a welcome change, but yet the fact that we expect further clarity around the drafting and additional work to be done on the underlying regulations to flesh out some of the third-party access issues. Thank you, Alan and Shamila, for sharing your detailed insights on the energy trends and legislative reforms shaping the energy sector across sub-Saharan Africa.
If you would like to get in touch or find out more about Bowmans, please visit bowmanslaw.com.